Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast. Today we've got a show that's kind of SDN related, but it's about some specific work going on in the IETF regarding a protocol called I2RS. It's early days for I2RS, and I brought on a couple of the guys that are heavily involved in the process and going back and forth in the drafts and on the mailing list discussing just what this protocol should do. And so on. And with me, of course, is co-host Greg Farrow. And Mr. Farrow from the UK, how are things?
Things are good. Things are good. I love talking about taxes.
No. You're talking about the first iteration, which was IRS. Yeah. And then they renamed it I2RS.
So the Americans must have this tax thing under control now. Is that what it is?
That's right. You nailed it.
I love taxes. Love taxes, me. Love me. No, I'm good. I'm good. I've been ensconced in the chair in my palace of productivity, with my screens lighting up my face, you know, bathing me in the glow of stuff. I've just about finished. I've just pressed a preview on a book I'm just about to publish, which is on commodity networking. I've been really taken by white box, and I've taken a small deviation to write a 10,000 word, which is a pretty long white paper. You know how it goes, Ethan, 10,000 words.
That is a bit of writing to do for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've done, 7,000, 8,000 words on what a white box means because, anyway, that'll come out in the next couple of months. It'll finish off and I'll be touting it around to people. It sort of explains where white, and that's been my emphasis for the last 10 days is really digging into why white box is going to be a thing going forward, because I think it's really going to change networking steadily. It's not going to come on us like a tidal wave in the next 6 months and everything's going to wash away and there'll be nothing left but skeletons of big companies on the beach. It'll be, you know, a gradual change as customers turn to white box and vendors and everybody, and it's a natural progression in the marketplace. It's not something special. And I try to explain all those things.
That will be an interesting white paper. I think Dell, with what they're doing with Cumulus and Pika8 and some of the other folks that are out there that are making some inroads, certainly are making the case that companies are interested in white box and the white box approach. So I'm sure that'll be a pretty keen white paper. Now, where are you going to publish that?
It'll be off LeanPub. If people are – I actually have published it. It will publish tonight, actually. If you want to get in on a heavily discounted version, that will be – it's about 60% incomplete. You can actually go to LeanPub and look for it if you know what you're looking at. I'm not going to sell it to you yet, but it's not finished. But if you want to get in and help me finish the book off and do – I do this thing called Lean Publishing, you know, Ethan, where I publish it early and then keep iterating it and then republish and add stuff. And so like the blogging book I published about 8 months ago has now sold 500 copies. And I continue to add little snippets about the way to approach writing and things like that. And so this one's going to be the same. I've published early. It's about 60% complete. If people want to read it and then send me questions, then I can write answers to those questions into the book. And I'd love to be able to, you know, and this is something different because this is actually going to be, I'm hoping it to be a series of what I call design documents. And these are a series of, you know, fairly long 40-page booklets on aspects of networking that we don't normally talk about. So I've got this one, which is about the impact of white box and how a white box switch is put together. You know, what goes inside a white box, right? It turns out that a white box is just a CPU, a fabric, and a memory module and some things, right? And it's just standard chips in the same way that a computer has a CPU, a memory, a bus, a hard drive, a monitor, a keyboard. So does a network switch, it turns out. And I think people should learn a little bit about that. So that's one. And I've got one coming up, which is about chassis design. So, you know, we look at these chassis that are being put together by Arista based on commodity products, and Cisco's got their chassis. Well, what happens inside that hardware? Because there's no place to go, which is a document which said this is how hardware works. So I want to sort of bring some documentation out around those and get people involved with helping to bring it out so everybody can see how switches are made. I mean, what's the difference between a mid-plane chassis and a non-mid-plane chassis?
Palace of productivity, indeed. You have been bathed in the glow.
But I was just thinking, you know, Greg, I don't think you can publish a white paper on white box. I think it needs to be a yellow paper. There's just something wrong about that.
Well, it's not a book, you see. So it's not, you know, a book is like the epic things that you write, Russ, because you've done a whole bunch of books, right? And I just don't have the I don't have the mental capacity, I think, to be able to stick at something the way that you do and churn out really serious and well done.
Look at it this way, Greg. You're just writing one chapter at a time. You're going to get all these done and then you're going to assemble it into one great big book.
Well, that's what I hope. And it lets me run one out the door because, you know, ultimately I'm trying to make a living out of this these days and run it out the door and then get feedback and then iterate over it. And there's a lot of information on this white box you just can't get. Like, there's not public information for this stuff. And the people who know this stuff are I was chatting to one guy who we are going to do a podcast in a few weeks, and he's actually one of the hardware designers for the high-end Cisco routers. And I've got some other engineers lined up to actually talk about processors and XFPs and FSP and internal architectures and how these, you know, how our switches are put together and to, you know, and these guys are, don't normally get to come out in public and explain how crossbar fabrics work, and doing multicast replication on the outbound side of the fabric gives you this much more I/O band. You know, these types of things we don't know about.
And that other voice you heard earlier, who I haven't mentioned yet, was Russ White. Now, Russ has been on the show a number of times before. But Russ, for folks that maybe haven't heard you, why don't you introduce yourself and tell folks what you do?
I am a network architect. Right now I'm working in the IPOS team at Ericsson as a principal engineer, just doing stuff, mostly data center stuff. Next week, actually, I am at NANOG talking about network complexity. Doesn't that sound exciting? Sounds complex, right? That's what it is. it actually is. It was a complex process getting into NANOG to speak there. But for anybody who's at NANOG, by the way, Mark Burley emailed me, and he said they're doing a panel on white box. So, Greg, if I can try to get a recording of that for you, I will. Or whatever, it'll be on NANOG's website, so it might be helpful. Besides that, my new book is, speaking of books, is coming out in April, I think, March or April. I can't remember which month, but it's the 9th of one of those 2 months, somewhere in there. It's complexity again. And that's on the Art of Network Architecture, which Ethan and Denise and I did a show on recently. And, you know, I'm already talking to Cisco Press and ACM and a bunch of other people about whatever is next in my life as far as writing goes.
No. See, on the show that we recorded, you said we're not going to do any more books or something to that effect.
No more Cisco Press books because
I've
been kicked out of Cisco Press because I work for a competitor now.
Ah.
So I'm writing on Pearson's as of right now, and maybe ACM. I haven't gotten through that yet.
Well, Russ, thank you for joining us today to talk about I2RS and for being the liaison to get our next guest, which is Joel Halpern. Joel, thank you for joining us on the Packet Pushers podcast. Would you do the same Russ did? Just introduce yourself and tell folks what you do.
Be happy to. I am currently a distinguished engineer with Ericsson. I think they've taken to calling me the SDN evangelist. I'm concerned with standardization and technology related to SDN in almost every way you can imagine, which means it's more different things than I care to think about sometimes. I've been building routers almost longer than there were routers. I go back a long ways in this business. I was the routing area director from 1994 to 1998. I'm currently on the IAB at the IETF. I co-chair a working group on keying and authentication for routing protocols, just trying to improve that space. I actually co-chair the LISP working group, which some of the LISP folks consider to be relevant to SDN. And I'm very active in the I2RS group, which is what brings us here today. I've been doing routers and all things related to them for a long time. Also actually involved over at the ONF in various activities and other places.
Well, I might harass you about LISP sometime. I heard a really interesting presentation at the Open Daylight Summit regarding LISP flow mapping and how it's used to perform service chaining, which I was just a fascinating presentation and something I'm going to research a bit more.
The one that Vina and Sharon did?
That's correct.
Yeah, very interesting presentation.
They're going to work at it long enough to find an actual use case for that technology.
Wow.
Yep, Dino Farinacci is. I've been told that Dino Farinacci is never going to let it go. I put a Twitter out the other day pointing out that LISP is not the only hip host identity protocol.
For that point, since we've mentioned it, I actually consider ILNP to be another interesting protocol in that space, the Identifier Locator Network Protocol.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we kick off the conversation regarding I2RS with just a basic introduction to what it is for the audience. And Joel, would you like to take a stab at that? Tell us, you know, at the basics, what is I2RS? What is the point of it? And then we'll get into a deeper discussion.
Probably the easiest way to look at I2RS is that a lot of the SDN conversation started out by assuming there is a dumb forwarder and a box talking to it. That was where everybody was looking. And okay, that is a useful piece of the puzzle. But when you look at any real network, you have these like intelligent boxes, brains. We call them routers. Whether that's actually a router, as all of us build, or whether it's a controller controlling a dumb forwarder, doesn't matter. From the point of view of an operator or an enterprise, he's got these things which run routing protocols, apply policy, and think in terms that are not about forwarding flows. So I2RS is an effort to define how SDN can interact with, how, even if you don't want to call it SDN, how can a policy controller or an application interact with a router to affect the policies, the behaviors, the routing at that level of abstraction. And that's the core goal. Now, one of the interesting things is, I think Greg mentioned the question of protocol. I2RS may turn out to need a new protocol. It may turn out to use existing protocol. That actually isn't settled. What's important is to create the abstraction, the architecture, and the information models that will then drive data models in a protocol that will let somebody actually do the job. And there is a list as long as your arm of use cases for this thing.
Now, if I am someone who's used to, say, BGP and setting up a BGP network and programming my routing tables with BGP, how does I2RS fit into that scheme?
So you still run BGP. You still have your BGP policies. And in normal operation, you want those to be right. So you worry about those. You worry about maintaining them. But now you have some application that needs to interact with the BGP behavior. One of the classic use cases here is intrusion detection. You have an intrusion detection system that concludes that some set of sources are in a constitute an attack. And what you want to do is create the BGP route that will black hole that, preferably upstream. BGP already has the mechanisms for carrying that. So how do you tell your BGP system to do this? Currently, a human being walks over to a keyboard and tries to type the right things. That's really awkward for innumerable reasons. So instead, what we want to do is create a mechanism by which the intrusion detection application can tell a suitable router in the network, here is a new piece of BGP behavior. Use this in addition to your policy so as to black hole this DOS until I tell you to stop.
So I'll just inject a little bit there, because it sounds an awful lot like, from that perspective, that you're just actually automating the configuration process. And that's really only piece of what I2RS is trying to do. We're also, just to carry it further, because listeners may not understand exactly like, okay, you know, when you say, okay, I'm going to go stop having to type this stuff, it almost sounds like I'm just going to use Yang or Netconf, and I'm just going to actually configure the router. But that's actually only one little piece. You know, part of what we're trying to do here is to get interaction with the routing table or with the routing protocol itself, so that rather than putting the policy on the box, you actually inject the right routes to implement the policy without it. Joel, would you put it that way? I mean, to me, I'm trying to reach beyond just replacing the configuration and SNMP. You know, I'm trying to actually get to the point where I'm actually injecting the policy directly into the network so that the network does what I want it to do.
I think that is indeed the goal. In the BGP space, most of the knobs have been exposed by CLI, and you could imagine exposing them with NetConf and Yang, and that may even be the interface for that particular problem.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other mechanisms that routers have internally that are very difficult to expose right now. And a lot of the work is focused on getting good abstractions for RIBs and policy routing and other things so the applications can interact with those in ways that they simply couldn't when you didn't have an interface.
Yeah.
Even CLI couldn't get at some of these things up till now.
Going back to my complexity talk, one of the things that we talk about in the art of network architecture, and I'm talking about, actually I had to take it out of my slides at NANOG because I don't have enough space to cover it, is this concept of policy dispersion versus policy centralization. And one thing that I always hope that I2RS is going to do is to allow me to keep a distributed control plane in place while centralizing the policies that go with that distributed control plane. In other words, I don't want to centralize routing per se, although there may be a layer between I2RS and the actual forwarding boxes that kind of does that in some way. From a perspective of a network operator, what I really want to do is I want to centralize my policy. I want to stop going out to each individual box and figuring out what community string I have to configure on BGP to make some router 10 hops away black hole a particular route or a particular destination or reroute instead of using hot potato to use cold potato. Now, what I really want to do is I want to say, all right, here, make this route cold potato, and boom, the centralized policy mechanism knows what needs to be done to make all of that happen, and I can stop thinking about what needs to be done to make all that happen.
Agreed, Russ. One way of phrasing it very tersely is that people talk in SDN about centralization. The point here is to marry centralized policy with distributed control and distributed operation to get the strengths of both.
So, Ethan, did we answer your question, or are we actually?
I think we get the basics of it. Greg, what's your take on what you've heard so far?
Well, I think a lot of people think that SDN is about centralizing the control plane, and that's where we started off because we talk about a controller. But the point is that the only way to manage configurations of 500 distributed devices is to bring the configurations into some sort of to apply some sort of reduction to the configuration process, because you can't treat 500 devices as individually configured, right? And so for people to say SDN is about centralizing is not actually true. What you're actually doing is just centralizing the configuration. The forwarding is still done distributed. The decisions are still done distributed, but you don't go to 500 devices to make the configuration. You go to one place to make the configuration change. The controllers themselves might be distributed. So we're seeing products like Contrail and ACI talk about having massively distributed controllers, one in each five in each data center is becoming, I've heard stories of, if you're going to have multiple data centers with the policy, then you have to have multiple controllers for scale, and then you have a table which then distributes the policy between all of those data centers so that it's consistent. That's not centralized, that's distributed. It's just not distributed to every device, because 500 control points has become an operational disaster. It's just, the complexity of that is so hard that you can't reduce it to something simple.
Well, but Greg, I think I would say there, okay, so it depends on what you mean by configuration. When we think of SDNs, quite often when I talk to people, they say, I mean, I'm configuring the forwarding table directly. That's the configuration level I'm at. I2RS isn't there. What I2RS is saying, you let OSPF, ISIS, BGP build their distributed shortest path first network. That's what they do. They do it really well. They go out there, they do that, they build this great shortest path tree. You can do aggregation, although in reality, aggregation is a form of policy. But, you build this really great shortest path tree, but now you have to build an overlay network. Okay, well, there's two ways of going about that. One is you go out and touch all the boxes that need to be touched to make that overlay network work, right? Mm-hmm. Another is to take all the control plane, all of the policy required to build that centralized control plane, that overlay network, including the actual forwarding information, and you pull it all into a controller. That's kind of what we think of as SDN. In other words, what we say is I'm just going to, it's so much simpler for me to build the distributed overlay, the overlay in a centralized manner. I'm going to go ahead and build the underlay network, the shortest path first in a centralized manner as well. What I2RS is trying to do is say, no, look, OSPF does a great job. ISIS does a great job. BGP does a great job. Yes, it's complex to build the overlay network. So let's pull just the piece of building the overlay network into a centralized control plane and leave the shortest path first. Leave the base topology out there. Let the protocols do what they want to do. And then
So my point is that I agree with you that SPF works, but it only works if you understand enough about SPF to architect the network so that SPF works the way you expect. Right? What I mean is, today, when we use SPF algorithms, be it ISIS or OSPF, that means that there has to be somebody in charge of the network who puts together a design which addresses the weaknesses in SPF designs. So people like me and you say this network connection from this point to this point, and here's the router goes here. Now, these are the interfaces. The SPF calculation is going to do this. We can only have 400 routers in a zone, so we need to make sure that we have areas, and then we have to have, you know, all these arbitrary rules around the control that we have to fit. SPF is very good, but it also creates the impost, the tax to configure it and maintain it is unbelievably high. The price that we pay to maintain SPF at sizes and to address the rules that we have is beyond what we can afford going forward, in my view.
Greg, let me, however, disagree with one assumption in there. I mean, I absolutely agree that the complexity for the human operation of these protocols is hard. But the illusion that somehow by putting an SDN controller in instead of these routing protocols, it's somehow just going to magically work. The same problems that drive the scale limitations in any routing protocol or any other system are going to affect the controller. That's why I tend to think about it as that what we're doing, we're going to be doing with SDN is iterative separation, where you will take a controller controlling a set of forwarders. You will then want those controllers to work together. The routing protocols are the best art we've found for doing that. And then above that, you will need policy that has to be coordinated, as Russ was hammering on. And so you will have controllers operating at the policy level.
Okay.
And above that, you may have application controllers that are driving the policies even. So you're
I'm not going to dispute your – so I take your point there, right? What you're saying is if I use an SPF algorithm to calculate a pass through the network – and I do it using an OSPF or ISIS, or whether I do an SPF algorithm on an SDN controller, it doesn't make any difference. You're correct, right? But in a controller platform, I get network visibility, which I do not get with OSPF or BGP. Those protocols do not give me any insight into the network architecture because they have no APIs that let me scrape that data to get to that data to extract the network configuration. I'm stuck with this rubbish CLI and no way of extracting the configuration of the network. So that it takes companies like Carradine, who have a decade of mathematics, to be able to build models of BGP and MPLS from the LDP protocols to be able to say this is what those protocols do. What SDN gives me is the visibility.
Well, SDN doesn't, but I2RS may.
Yeah.
Would be where I go from there. Because the point is that I2RS should enable you to have a policy controller, a network controller, that collects the information from the routers. We don't ask the routers to produce a topology view. They have too small a view. But we make it much, much easier to collect the information. And then once you've collected it and analyzed it in some sort of a topology and policy application, to turn around and apply policy behaviors in conjunction with that behavior. So you have a robust network. One of the issues that people observe is that if you have a single controller or even a pair trying to control the whole network, then if you have communications problems, the network no longer has a brain. If you use routing and you use distributed protocols at a mid-level, let them do their job. You have a robust network, which you can then, using tools like I2RS, in particular, this is what I2RS is aimed at, you can then apply policy to that. Get information you need and apply policy.
Maybe we need to explain what I2RS is, because I've struggled to find good data on what an introduction to IRS that I could readily absorb.
So Greg, I want to back up one second there before we even talk about that, is that there is this sense in the networking world or in the world, in the networking world, but in the larger computer industry or networking industry that, you know, we can get rid of this stupid stuff called failure domains and we can make design into an algorithm if we can just centralize everything. And I think that we're going to run down that path, and we're going to find out that it doesn't really work.
So Joel and Russ both, I take it, looking at the open flow approach, you are opposed to that for reasons here that you've been citing regarding the advantages of a distributed routing protocols and so on.
Open flow is useful. I am not claiming open flow does not have a place in an SDN environment. So the most obvious use is use OpenFlow between our routing brain that's running the routing protocols and the actual forwarders. Because I actually like, I mean, I've been working on distribution and separation of forwarding and control since 1994. So this notion that you want to separate the routing from the forwarding, yes, you do. And OpenFlow is one of the viable protocols in that space. What we're talking about with I2RS is a layer above that, not instead. I mean, I'm not insisting that a router be a single device, but it will look to I2RS like a router, whether it is actually a single chassis or a controller running IPOS as Rust builds that is in turn talking to forwarders using OpenFlow or forces or whatever. I2RS doesn't care. It's talking at the next layer of abstraction up from what OpenFlow operates at.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. I think I've heard I2RS described as kind of a shim between the rib and the fib. Is that fair or not really?
No, between the rib and the routing protocol.
I think of it as above the rib is the point.
Right.
I2RS is above.
So if you could take BGP and run it on a separate box from where your rib lives,
yep.
If you could actually run BGP on one box and your rib on another box, that interface is somewhat what we're looking at with I2RS. If you run your rib on one box and your fib on another box, that's kind of where you're getting with OpenFlow and forces. That's very rough, and that's very, you know, there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts in there, but that's kind of a taxonomy you can put in your head to think about it.
BGP would do path computation and so on and program the rib, and then I2RS would have some influence on what goes on there to implement specific policy, which would then get pushed into the rib, and then the rib would program the fib. So that is about where we're at.
The descriptions get confusing because, as with many things in the SDN space, everybody wants to use the hammer in their hand to solve all the problem. So we're using I2RS to program ribs, but we're also using I2RS to program routing protocol policy.
Yeah, that's, no wonder.
Yeah, we have
no
to be a little bit not to mislead folks, because right. It is the models. One of the important set of models is going to be the protocol models, and in fact, the most important one would be the BGP policy model, since that is a model that has not been abstracted well to date.
Right. Right. So that
and
is
one
why
of the goals we're really hoping for is to get a good model.
Yeah, that's actually one of the confusing things, like you're saying, Greg, is that I2RS is kind of bifurcated right now. It actually is like a dual-pronged or a fork-in-the-road type of thing. There's one specific piece of it that's very focused on acting like an off-box routing process, okay? As if, to the rib, routing processes like OSPF, ISIS, and BGP all look roughly the same. They install routes, they have admin distance preferences, they do blah, 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 blah. You know, they have next hops, they have MAC, you know, all this stuff. That's what a routing protocol looks like to the rib, or a routing process. So I2RS is, in one sense, attempting to emulate a routing process, but not necessarily on box. Could be, maybe not. The second piece that I2RS is trying to address, however, is you have community strings in BGP. Today, how do you set the community string? Oh, I'm going to go in and I'm going to set a route filter, or I'm going to set up some sort of configuration, and I'm going to do all this stuff and do a match, and I'm going to set the match against a community with a route map and blah, blah, blah. I2RS is also trying to say, all right, let's give ourselves the ability to reach into the BGP table, as it were, in the BGP database, and directly modify that community or modify the configuration that modifies.
So what we probably need to do is take a step back here. So the fib, let's just explain the difference between the fib, the rib, and the BGP table here, right? So the fib is the actual forwarding table that's inside the silicon of the router or the switch.
Yep.
And it is, right? The rib is the routing information base, and it is the IP routing table that is extracted from all the possible IP routing protocols in the box. So if you sometimes were thinking of a rib as, if you've got OSPF, RIP, and BGP all running on the router, then the rib is where the final selection process of all the best possible routes from all the protocols ends up in the rib. The rib then selects the best possible route for a single destination. The rib then selects one IP address, one path for each IP subnet or each prefix, and then passes that data to the FIB for forwarding. So it says this IP
can select multiple ones that it considers equivalent. Yeah. And in modern devices, it may put in backups, but conceptually, yeah, it picks the answer based on what all the routing protocols say, puts all of their data together, and then produces an answer to put into the FIB.
That's right. And so then you've got the BGP table, which is the routing protocol above the RIB, which is receiving all of the BGP updates from all of the neighbors, and it has the database of all the BGP routes, and it's the one that's processing the updates and evaluating the community strings and applying the weight and the preferences and evaluating the meds and all the various BGP knobs and levers that we really shouldn't have, you know, that takes you 5 years to work out what the hell they all are, because they're all so painfully obvious and well-named, and then runs a pass selection process. And once it picks out the best possible one, then it hands that down to the RIB below it.
I just think it's funny when Greg starts talking about meds. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Still, the description is accurate. And yes. I2RS is to enable an application, what we call an I2RS client, to talk to the RIB and to the routing protocols. That's its target space.
Right. So it can talk directly to the BGP.
Maybe we should pick just the RIB, but that's the way we structured the working group.
Yeah, no doubt there was some idiot in a service provider who said he doesn't just want to talk to BGP, he wants to talk to the RIB directly.
Many people who wanted to talk to both.
Actually, it's the other way around. I think I2RS really started wanting to talk to the RIB, but then we got all these use cases that started talking about, well, we should be able to talk to BGP as well. So, you know, that's been a bit of the scope around it. But either way, it doesn't really matter. That's kind of where the scope is today.
Mm. Well, you know, I'll get on my hobby horse about that later if we get enough time. Okay, so I2RS defines a process or a conceptual operational environment where the routing process, you know, such as BGP and the RIB, can be manipulated directly by an external app.
Yes, that's essentially what we're after, correct. So right now where we are is we're trying to build use cases so that we can build a data model around those use cases to understand exactly what needs to be exposed. And right now we're not talking about the how. We don't really care what that protocol looks like right now.
We're putting together the architecture of the system.
Yes.
That's the other main thing we're doing so that we can actually provide a how that meets an agreed and achievable set of goals. Probably the biggest problem, and this is a common problem in all IETF working groups, is to focus the task. It's all too easy to say, wait, I need a bit of this and I need a bit of that. And by the way, is there an ocean I can boil while I'm doing it? And it's tempting.
Yeah. Yep. It's world hunger tempting. Needs solving as well. Yeah.
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah. But we're trying to focus. And so the architecture document is making some specific choices and saying, yeah, we'd like to do, oh, things start and stop automatically and many people are arbitrated. No, we're not doing many of the more complex aspects of this to try to get a deliverable architecture that actually solves a reasonable set of problems and can be built. I mean, Ed Crabb, as the co-chair, keeps going, I need something that folks can actually build. And he's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't want it to overlap with other efforts, other things that are going on in the IETF either. You said ocean boiling is the constant temptation, but there's other efforts going on within the IETF for similar kind of work. Maybe you could explain I2RS versus NetConf and Yang and maybe Forces. I mean, these are all different projects, things that are going on right now. How are all these connected?
Okay, so NetConf and Yang started out as an effort to modernize our network management. And they have made significant strides in that space. Probably the most important piece for us at this point in this conversation is that Yang is a way to describe a data model. Now, remember I said much earlier, I2RS isn't a protocol. One of the things that's going to have to happen is we're going to have the decision as to what protocol and what data modeling are we going to use to actually deliver I2RS. One of the leading contenders for this is Yang, carried either over NetConf or some successor to NetConf, because it's a data modeling language. Now, NetConf itself was designed with a certain operating paradigm in mind, and that may not be the right fit for I2RS. Another candidate for the data modeling and protocol is Forces. Forces was designed to address controlling a forwarding plane, but the design is very object-oriented. classes and instances with structure and semantics. So that could also be a data modeling tool for I2RS. And the working group is going to have to decide which one it wants to use.
And that was made pretty plain in one of the I2RS drafts that you're not looking to, you know, define a new language here. You want to use, or a new protocol here. You want to use something that exists if possible. But then the question is, what would that be? So that makes sense. That's where NetConf, Yang, and perhaps Forces are gonna factor in.
The chairs have been asking specifically for presentations on the applicability and gaps for the upcoming meeting in London.
Right. So the big thing right now is to build a framework, build the use cases, understand the architecture, and then we can go back and evaluate NetConf, Yang, Forces, and all these other things and say, yeah, we can actually use this, or yes, we can actually use that. And, you know, it may end up in the end that we don't end up with, Joel's going to shoot me now, but that's okay. We may not in the end end up with a single solution. It may turn out that we have some people who implement Forces and some people who implement Yang NetConf. But see, now, we kind of like to avoid that because that gets back to the problem that Ethan was talking about, is that, you know, once I get to the point, you know, where I'm actually, what's the difference between having five different models and having five different CLIs, essentially, is what we may come down to. So, you know, we're trying to make the model the most consistent that we can and make it where we can implement one thing or we can choose one thing, as the case might be.
I'm not going to shoot you for that. I have to agree that there is a significant risk in that direction. I'm hoping we can get one protocol because it'll make the operation much simpler. One of the weaknesses over in the OpenFlow is that you have the OpenFlow switch, the classic OpenFlow protocol, and you have OFconfig, and you have to coordinate the two. And if you have to coordinate multiple protocols, your life gets much more complicated. So I hope we can get one. And having said that, we know that the models, whatever the protocol, the models will not cover everything we'd like to cover. Extensibility is going to be a key for I2RS because you have to have the ability to add models for the problems you want to address.
Right. Well, even if you end up with something like NetConf plus OpenFlow as an I2RS solution in the long run, just to throw, you know, some sort of combination on the table as a point of discussion, what you don't want, oh, we're going to use NetConf and we're going to use Forces and we're going to use OpenFlow, right? Because now you've got Greg sitting over there going, again, I used to have my Juniper, Cisco, and Ericsson CLIs, and now I have my Cisco, Juniper, and Ericsson I2RS interfaces.
You know, certainly the noises that we're seeing coming from the companies are saying, we don't want to be locked into any particular vendor. We want to have products that are realistically interchangeable. We don't want to have Cisco's BGP not working with Juniper's BGP or MPLS or LDP, or, you know, you have to get out a special magic wand to make them interoperate. That's what we don't want to have happen.
Agreed.
But Greg, you own the magic wand, so.
That's right.
Well, the problem that I'm having there is that right now, like, I was recently talking to something called the Cloud Ethernet Forum, and they're off reinventing the wheel. Unfortunately, their wheel's got five sides and the axle's not quite in the middle. They want to make Ethernet everywhere. They want to be able to, they reckon, over at the Metro Ethernet Forum, they reckon that the whole wide world wants Ethernet everywhere from point to point, according to them. And they're looking to scale up Ethernet to host, you know, every data center in the world to do DCI, which is ludicrous, right? But there are service providers out there who think that that's the future, right? And then we've got these projects coming out of the IETF doing I2RS, PCEP, and then you've got people like the ONS, and they're all standing up and saying code is standards and we don't need standards.
Because you raised that bugaboo, and I don't blame you for raising it. There are folks who are saying this. You absolutely need standards. As one of my colleagues put it, you need to take the problem, figure out what problem you're going to solve, think about it, write down the results of the thinking so you can figure out what it takes to really get interoperation and reliable operation, and then you cut code. If you cut code first, you're not going to end up with interoperation because you're going to be busy fixing that code for the next 20 years. And yes, right, you know, some folks don't just go, oh, we'll just cut better code. Not everybody upgrades all at the same time. We got to figure out how we're going to actually make this work before folks start deploying.
Right. Well, and beyond all that, right, Greg, the other problem that people aren't thinking about is going back to those. There is a reason we aggregate. And it's not because, oh, we can't make OSPF carry a million routes. Frankly, we could make OSPF carry a million routes. Be my guest, you know, let's do it. But is that what you want? I mean, in the real world, you know, we build houses with firewalls between the garage and the living space, right? There's a reason we do that. It's called breaking up failure domains, right? If your car catches on fire, you don't want your house to go with it. Thank you. Well, we don't think in those terms in the network world. We just seem to think I can build the world's largest failure domain. As long as I do a really good job of building it, I don't need firewalls. I don't need failure domain breakpoints anymore. I don't need policy points in my network. And yep. It's just not going to work. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, right? The problem that we have with networking is, of course, that anybody is allowed to do anything stupid. And service providers are the examples of it. You know, they're all racing out to do silly things at the moment with Ethernet.
Well, they're doing. Let's be fair to them. They're doing these things to meet real needs they have. And part of the goal here with I2RS is we have to give them a way to apply these policy controls, or they will find ways to do it that work much worse.
Right. Well, they're illustrating that the number one ironclad rule of all technology, right, which is that technology solutions are never applied the way they were intended to be applied. They're always applied to the utmost limit of what the technology can do, and often far beyond what the technology can do. So, you know, this is another ball of the ocean moment, right, where we're sitting around going, well, I could do this, but, hey, I can do that, and 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 that, and that, and that.
Well, in the context of I2RS, why don't we get into some of the use cases here? Because there's people that have to be coming to the IETF saying, I have this problem I need to solve. How are we going to do it? And now I2RS is being discussed. So, Ross, you got some of these use cases?
Sure. I mean, Joel mentioned one earlier, which is the remote triggered black holes use case, right? Where, you know, today you can screen scrape 5 different routers and go out and configure all your routers at the edges to black hole stuff. And so BGP has the ability through FlowSpec and some other ways of actually carrying a negative route, if you want to call it that. You know, a route that says, I don't want to route to this destination. I don't want to route to this destination from this source. So that is one specific use case that's really interesting, because you can say, okay, instead of actually doing all the configuration work, I can simply have an I2RS controller reach into either the RIB at all the edge boxes, or I can actually have the I2RS controller reach into BGP and install the right route to make the right policy happen without configuring that route map and without doing all that static route stuff and everything else. Another really interesting one is DDoS protection, right? So here I have a DDoS protection system where I'm effectively drawing your traffic off of your enterprise edge and sucking it into a big data center and scrubbing it so you get clean pipes. Okay, but what if I could put an I2RS controller or if I could actually touch your RIB or your BGP policy in a way remotely where I could put a sensor out at your enterprise edge, and when I see an attack, I can redirect just that attack traffic through my data center. I mean, that's a win-win for everybody, right? Because now my data center doesn't have to handle 100% of your enterprise traffic just to make sure it's clean. Your users don't see their traffic going through my data center, taking the hit in latency and jitter. The providers don't take the hit in terms of carrying the traffic across multiple hits and hops. So now I'm in a position where I can actually dynamically react to what's going on in the network in a way that allows me to provide services in real time, but without having to carry the traffic on a permanent basis, because I now have a control plane that can react to the applications in a way. So do those make sense, Ethan?
Yeah, you're doing, effectively, it's exception processing. It's a bit of traffic steering. And I've heard these kind of use cases used in some OpenFlow scenarios as well. In fact, solving the same problem a different way came up at the Open Daylight Summit. Again, where OpenFlow was the driver, but it was the same basic model, an application that was saying, hey, this is bad traffic, I'm going to shunt it over in this direction, null route, however the case may be, so that legitimate traffic could still make it through and not penalize everything else in that legitimate traffic path with garbage traffic.
Right, exactly. But the difference is in the OpenFlow case is you're kind of assuming that I either have coordination between my controllers and I have all the pieces in place to make provider A talk to provider B and to the enterprise customer to make all of this work. I2RS's assumption is I'm not going to have all those pieces. I need to build them. What better thing do we already have that to do this, which is called BGP, right? BGP already does this for a living. So if I can figure out a way to interact with BGP to inject the right information in the right places, and I can do it in a way where all the providers along the way trust me, now I've solved the problem from the policy to application side, and I can actually use OpenFlow to implement that policy change if I want to. Maybe I do, maybe I don't, but it leaves open the door of doing it at the lower level any way I want to.
So here's a point for you, right? So we've had BGP protocol for, what, 20 years now? Is it an air-cooled Volkswagen engine that really we should have just replaced with a V6, which is with a turbo by now? Is it really something that we want to carry forward into the next generation? Is it not a broken-down old hag with a pair of crutches?
Okay, first of all, I'm not going to tell Yakov and Tony that you said that, but...
I mean, I think these are the questions that we're not answering. Everybody says, well, we've got BGP, so we have to strap a pair of... it's like when you were 17, you got given a car. That was the only car you could afford. So you ran out and bought a pair of shiny mag wheels, turned them inside out, and, put a chrome tailpipe on your car, and you thought it was awesome, but it was still a shit car underneath.
Well, okay, yeah. Greg, let's separate a couple issues here.
Yeah.
BGP works amazingly well. Arguably, our biggest problem with BGP, in fact, is our tendency to turn it into the kitchen sink instead of the interdomain routing protocol.
Mm.
But that's a topic for another day.
So I'll take one point with you there, right? You said it works really well. I would only agree that it doesn't work very bad. Right? I don't believe that BGP is good, but I also agree that BGP is not bad. It's not inherently evil. It doesn't inherently not work. It's not dysfunctional like Microsoft Windows is, for example. Right?
On the other hand, agreeing with you,
yeah,
I have looked at trying to replace it. And this has nothing to do with SDN. You have all these operators who are running BGP talking to each other. Forget whether they're using it internally. If you are going to replace it, you have to replace it in such a way that the guy putting in something new gets value when the rest of the world hasn't yet done so. This is an incentives issue. It has nothing to do with technology. It is, aside from the fact that we described things in a way that completely lost everybody, this was what killed Nimrod. Nimrod was described badly, so people had trouble understanding it, but it was a really interesting approach to evolving us to a much better interdomain routing protocol, and it had no deployment model. No matter how much I want any piece of technology, unless there is a reason for folks to deploy it, we're going to continue to use what we have.
It's a bit like IPv6 has no transition from IPv4, but we have to deploy it anyway, right? Until the addresses ran out, nobody was going to, yeah.
Until we saw the brick wall of real address exhaustion, nobody bothered with transitioning to V6 because there was no reason.
No.
Right. And there are, Greg, by the way, efforts around that are thinking about ways of modifying BGP without replacing it, right? Mm-hmm. But so far, we haven't gotten a lot of traction on those. As a matter of fact, just to make you feel better, Greg, I was talking to Radia about maybe a week ago, week and a half ago, maybe 2 weeks ago now. Radia and I were on the phone. We were chatting about stuff, and she's like, isn't it about time we replace BGP?
I don't have new ideas. I'm just repeating other people's. That's really
yeah. There you go. But yeah. you're not in bed.
See, I knew that.
Yeah.
She thought of it first, not me.
But you're not in bad company when you're repeating what Radia is saying, right? So that's okay. But but nonetheless, it's just. Yeah, I mean, I agree, but as Joel said, this isn't necessarily – I mean, I use BGP as an example because that's what we have, right? That's what people use.
We do.
But in reality, the same model would work with OSPF, ISIS, dare I say EIGRP, even that stuff you put on your gravestone. What is that protocol you put on your gravestone? RIP. Yes. it'll work with any of these things. And if we replace BGP in the future – hey, it'll work with that too. I mean, you know, that's the general idea. If we build the model right, then we give ourselves that type of thing.
And the point of I2RS is it will have models for specific protocols, its overall operation is independent, so that if we find a way to evolve any of the dimensions of the underlying operation, and OpenFlow is an example of such an evolution, we work with it. I2RS doesn't care what's underneath. It wants to be able to apply the higher level policies. Another example use case from one of the many use case drafts is overlay networks. Overlays are very, very common. They are also very complicated. You have state to create in quite a number of points to get a good consistent overlay. Having a client that can apply the routing policy so that the automatic mechanisms we've worked out can then take their part and split the load between a central controller and a distributed mechanism to give you a robust overlay is very powerful. And that lets you make sure your overlay is aligned with your policy. You can do it by reaching down to the forwarders of each overlay edge, and that may be useful too, but it's really hard to get policy consistency that way.
Yeah, and I mean, that's where Lisp is coming from. Lisp is recognizing that you can't turn off BGP. You can't change BGP for that matter, because the service providers are all too lazy and too busy, you know, squeezing people for SMS messages to worry about actually doing something with their networks. You know, and Lisp sort of, is there a way to bridge Lisp into the core where we actually say Lisp and BGP merge in some way?
Let me take that apart a little bit. The goal when Lisp was started was not to take Lisp into the core, but to use Lisp to reduce the pressure on the core.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, whether Lisp can do that or not is still very much an open question. There's a very good reason Lisp is still experimental. It is not clear that the correct incentives for the needed forwarding and the needed control for internet-wide deployment of Lisp exist. But you wouldn't take Lisp and replace BGP. Rather, you would use it to allow BGP to do its core job, locator routing for the internet, and let Lisp take the, we need to be able to change our address easily, we need to be able to change our policies easily, piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
Now,
I2RS then gives us a way to what? Scale up the BGP control plane?
I2RS gives you a way to scale up your BGP policies and your ISIS policies and your RIB policies. And so in a data center, I2RS gives you a way to create RIB policies for handling traffic that you've determined needs special handling at the RIB layer. In the data center, I think we may well find that the OpenFlow policies will carry most of the weight. But even then, big data centers are just intensely, absurdly large. You don't want to try to do one OpenFlow controller for the whole network. So you still need a policy controller above your OpenFlow controllers that is applying RIB-level logic to decide what needs to happen, and then you can translate it down. So right. I don't expect to be using I2RS in the core of the net to manipulate core forwarding. Similarly, I don't expect to be using Lisp to manipulate core forwarding. I'd love to solve some of the core problems, but I haven't found the right knob to address those yet.
So Greg, part of the problem we get into in the technical world is that we tend to try to solve economic problems with technical solutions. And the basic underlying problem I think we have in the network core today is it is financially advantageous for providers to advertise more specific routes. Okay? So until we solve that problem, I don't care where you move the problem, you're not going to solve it. In other words, moving it from BGP to a Lisp mapping server doesn't solve the problem. It just moves the problem.
It moves, but it also relieves pressure in the underlying part that they won't pay to fix.
I do think this is the place where Russ and I differ. I do think that moving the problem can often help because you separate the problem domains, and if you can separate the problems, you can often use different tools that let you solve the problem, address the problems better. It doesn't solve the problem, but it may help the problem. But that's only if it's deployable.
Yeah. And the other problem is that sometimes the unintended consequences sometimes come back and bite us though, right? we move the problem to make it easier to solve. We solve it so well, all of a sudden we take all the pressure off, and now all of a sudden we scale the new system out to the point that we actually make it unscalable, and then we go out. I mean, you know, you're kind of in this.
But to return to the SDN topic, one of the reasons Lisp is of interest, and it is definitely of interest, is because if you start looking at overlays, you have a very basic problem with whatever overlay technology you're using that you need to map between your overlay addresses and your underlay addresses. It doesn't matter what tool you're using, you have to do this. And Lisp provides a very well-developed set of tools for exactly that problem, which is why Sharon and Vina and a lot of other people are looking at whether Lisp is applicable to data centers and applicable to enterprise SDN environments, because overlay is so powerful as a service segregation and service delivery mechanism. A lot of service chaining work, the NFV service chaining work, you want to deliver it with overlays.
Yeah.
And then you'll need mapping as well. You need to map flows to overlays and overlays to underlays. These are both tools which we have the right – we have relevant pieces here.
Yeah, I think that – I mean, complexity at the edge and simplicity at the core remains a core part of networking. You can use Lisp at endpoint data centers. NFV is like, you know, at POPs at the edge of the network. You'll use NFV to put services right at the edge of your network. But the core will probably still remain BGP. Now, whether you use overlays to lay the pathways between the endpoints or whether you use some other form of flow control, which is like very fine-grained BGP, I'm not too bothered about that. I mean, I guess one thing to sort of point out to people, to the listeners, perhaps the people who aren't sort of thinking about some of the challenges here, is to sort of list out why Lisp and I2RS are important. And let me just correct me if I get this wrong here. When you have routers that run BGP, they have to have sufficient memory to hold the BGP routing tables. And today that means they have to take the BGP routing tables that all the neighbors announce to them and hold all of those entries in memory and then compare them before they load the entries down to the RIB. The RIB takes up memory. It's a software. It sits in the CPU memory architecture on the control in the management plane. And once it does it, it loads all the entries into the FIB. But the FIB is actually in silicon. And the silicon is got very restricted number of entries that can be in that FIB. So the TCAM forwarding engines that are inside of those chips are very finite in size. So as the BGP table gets bigger and bigger, the TCAMs in our core routers have to get bigger and bigger because every route has to be in the TCAM to pass that, theoretically, at least theoretically, right?
We don't use TCAMs most of the time anymore because TCAM size limits are too low.
Yeah, so we've already gone past the theoretical limit of TCAMs, right? I didn't realize that, but anyway. So what we need to be able to say is there needs to be a way to cap the size of the BGP table. But the problem is at the same time is that with IPv4, people are announcing smaller and smaller subnets. So where people used to announce a /8 and then say it's at this data center, they're now announcing /16, /24s, /22s because they have redundancy. Everybody's into data center redundancy, so they announce subnets from either places. So the total number of BGP prefixes continues to climb over time, correct?
That's true, and definitely one of the problems.
Right, one of the problems. And of course, as the table gets bigger and bigger, flaps have more and more damage. That is, if you get a significant root flap, then the CPUs have to load and then analyze all the RIB tables and then load them into the FIB. So the devices have to get scale physically larger. And when I say scale, that's not scale as in to have 20,000 more interfaces. That means the CPU must be able to process the RIB in sufficient time to load the data into the FIB and recover from the event.
Yeah. Okay, but Greg, all of this goes back to the assumption that it's not financially advantageous to the provider to have the larger FIB in the first place. And I think that's where it all breaks down. Because in the real world, it is financially advantageous to the provider to have the larger FIB. More granular routes allows you more policy control, which allows you to make more money.
Russ, and remember to couple in, and the bigger cost of everybody else having those routes is one you don't pay.
Exactly. Exactly. So if I'm looking at your multi-homing scenario, right, if I could announce a /32, a host route in IPv4, and I could get your traffic to the specific server I want you to send it to, it costs me nothing to advertise a /32.
Mm-hmm.
right? So therefore, I can lay the cost on everybody else to get more efficient routing for my particular application.
Most of this is not the driver for I2RS.
No, none of this is really driving I2RS. Mm. I2RS is more around policy and more around centralizing the policy and not necessarily on the internet core at all. I mean, use the example of the DDoS, but I don't really consider that a core application per se in the internet. Like, I don't anticipate some DDoS protection provider going out and saying, I'm just going to advertise this stuff to the internet at global. No, that's not really what I see. Instead, what I see is I see this DDoS protection provider doing much like what Google or Akamai does, right? Which is, I'm going to go to provider Sprint or provider level 3, and I'm going to ask them if I can interact with them to help provide this service in a more efficient way to their customers to take load off of their network effectively. There's going to be a control plane state trade-off there, but the trade-off is going to be, you know, minimal compared to the amount of traffic and bandwidth and things like that that go on, if that makes sense.
No, I don't think I understood that, I'll be honest.
Okay. So
it's not your fault necessarily. It might be mine, but I'm not, you know.
So look,
I've never been able to find something that explains I2RS to my...
Okay, see what Akamai does today, or any CDN, right? They go to a provider and they say, you give us rack space in your data center close to where the eyeballs are, right? And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to download the content that 90% of your users are trying to get to, or 20% or whatever the number is. And I'm going to load that locally once, and then I'm going to load it. I'm going to let only your edge network take the bandwidth cost. Okay? So this is effectively how they get into these data centers. What I'm saying with I2RS is you can actually say, I'm going to do the same thing with DDoS. The DDoS use case is that as a DDoS protection provider, as a cloud provider providing clean pipe service, I can actually say to Sprint, look, you can either pull all of the traffic for this enterprise, 10 gig or whatever it is, into my data center and route it back across your network to the enterprise customer, your customer, or you can cooperate with me. We can play a game where I put the sensor on your network edge, right? And now when I sense an attack, I only do redirect the traffic that's needed to be cleaned.
Let me try a different, more general approach to this, Greg. Let me see if I can get at this from a different angle.
Okay.
Over the last 10 years or so, all of the major routing vendors have developed or worked on SDKs. What are these SDKs? They're ways for applications to interact with the routing platform. Juniper has one, Cisco has one, Ericsson has his internal stuff. I'm sure Alcatel-Lucent has some stuff. I don't know what they call theirs. Because the operators have said, we have applications which need to interact with your routing platform. They need to get information, and they need to modify the behavior of the routing platform. That is the fundamental driver for I2RS. The specific applications may vary, whether it's overlay management or DDoS protection or quality of service delivery, or and the list goes on and on.
Mm.
It's driven by the vendors were asked by their customers, by large enterprise and by operator, to provide a way for applications to interact effectively with the router. I2RS is a standardized mechanism to allow effective high-rate data consumption by these applications. So you can get all of the routing changes without having to build an OSPF instance and an ISIS instance and a BGP instance into your app, which that's never been a good answer. And to apply changes, to apply policy back based on whatever it is the application is trying to do. Some folks think of this as network slicing. Some folks think of it as overlay. It goes on. And one of the problems we've had has been that because everybody has their own application in their head, driving the commonalities to get an architecture and figure out which pieces we need information models for has been difficult. And that's why you find it confusing, because you see this raft of use cases and they don't even look like they're really common to you. The commonality is this underlying driver.
The other reason you might find it confusing, Greg, is because given that this is supposed to be an open interface, one of the threats to the I2RS work, one of the things that we're facing is that, hey, I mean, you know, I work for Ericsson. We would love to have the I2RS interface be our interface, right? And so would Juniper, and so would Cisco. And so, you know, but this is the game of the IATF. This is what you do in the IATF anyway, is that I'm sure that when Cisco came out with BGP, they would have preferred that, you know, everything go their way. But in reality, you've got to work with other vendors. So that's what the IATF is all about, is trying to figure out, okay, which pieces of the Ericsson interface do we use, and which pieces of the Cisco interface, and which pieces of the Juniper, and which pieces of the Alcatel, and how do we make all of this stuff work? What are the most logical pieces? Or do we chuck it all and just invent something new, right?
I2RS really does need multi-vendor support, though, too, because you don't have any network that lives with one vendor's equipment, so really, this has got to be a cross-platform effort, and there's an agent that would have to be coded by a vendor for their specific platforms, right?
Yep.
That's the architecture, and that's why we want a RIB model, so that Cisco, Juniper, Ericsson, Alcatel-Lucent, and everybody else can look at it and say, yes, this is a common model that meets 80% of the things we're asked for, and that we can all support. It's not going to do everything everybody wants, but it's going to be common so that you can actually use it across the platforms.
And it should be extensible as well. And that's one of the things I2RS is really focused on as well, is being extensible, you know, because we're going to find new things in 6 years or 2 years or 6 months or 6 weeks or 6 days or...
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with what's happening in open daylight, is I think they're running around going, code is king, we can whip it all up in a week and it'll work, and bugger waiting around for standards to happen. But I don't think they're looking at extensibility or, you know, coherence between the possible options. They seem to all be running around congratulating themselves how clever they are.
So does I2RS have a lot of traction? I mean, is there a lot of groundswell behind it, and can folks get involved in it if they want to?
There's plenty of room. I'd love to get folks involved. You know, folks who come from different problem domains would be even better, because then you'll look and say, oh, we can add something. And the IATF runs on open email lists. There is i2rs@iatf.org is the mailing list. Anybody is absolutely welcome to participate in the work. I'd love to have more people active, document reviewers, authors, even just people participating in the discussion would be helpful. And the work is still actually relatively early. We're getting close to agreement on the architecture, so it would be a good time to get in and say, yes, I see that architecture document. I agree with that set of compromises to get something deliverable or not. If we've done it wrong, we need to know. And then we're going to be doing the information models. And to make sure those models reflect the real problems people have, we need more people.
Yeah. In fact, there's been an effort within the Latin America area specifically of getting more operators involved in the IATF. Well, I would extend that further. To me, if you run a network and you have the time and the inclination to get involved in the IATF, particularly for us, for Joel and I right now, I2RS is a huge deal. You know, it's a lot of what we're doing in the IATF. So yes, please join the mailing list. You know, get involved. There's room to get involved. There are documents to be read. There are documents to be written. Ali and I were just talking about three documents that need to be written that I'm going to start working on as soon as I can get a little bit of time to find out who it is I'm supposed to be gathering with and do it. So, I mean, this stuff needs to be done, and we need people from a more diverse set of groups than, you know, traditionally the IATF is built around the guys who write the code. And that's good, but we need more than that. So I2RS specifically, where we are right now, architecture, understanding where things are, yes, definitely. There's room to get involved, and there's room to have an influence right now.
Okay, and we will put links into the show notes that will lead you right into the I2RS working group papers, the drafts that have currently been submitted, and the use cases, and so on. So you can jump right in. I was on a plane this week and read through the major topology design, kind of the conceptual, this is what we think I2RS should be draft. And it is straightforward reading. I mean, it does kind of assume you're familiar a bit with network architecture and what's going on. But beyond that, it's written in plain English. It's not like trying to read an academic doctoral proposal or something like that. So you can really, if you have an interest, just start getting into the documents and then participating in the mailing list. And as I said, we'll put links in the show notes.
So far, none of the obscuration people have joined in the conversation for ITRS. We haven't passed it through the obscuration or whatever your obfuscation phase of the internet draft process.
That does happen. That's compulsory, isn't it? At some point.
It is.
But it does baffle me that every time I turn around, somebody says we can solve that problem with BGP and MPLS. And I sort of think, and you know, people still drive around a Volkswagen Beetle because, you know, with an air filter.
I think the Beetle is the wrong analogy. It's much more, yes, you could use a hatchback car as your work lugging vehicle and your vacation and your this. But you know, it gets really awkward. Yeah. If you use different vehicles, you might actually be happier.
Yeah, actually, in the case of BGP, you're actually using an 18-wheeler Mack truck to get back and forth to work.
That's a better analogy. And we've been filling the back of that Mack truck for the last 25 years.
Actually, I see BGP more as like a tram. It runs on tracks. And that's all it does, right? And if you want to take it in a different direction, you have to build a new tram track. It's not flexible and creative like, and I think that's what I2RS is trying to achieve, is to extend the capabilities of BGP to be more flexible. I mean, BGP is fundamentally resistant to propagating routes. Carriers don't like the idea of routes changing in flight because that might cause some damage. I mean, I've seen operational people actually use static routing just because it can't ever change and they can never be blamed for outages. And I cheer them on, right? Because management has said, if anything changes in the network, it's your fault. So you configure your network so nothing changes. So anything that goes wrong is not your fault, right? It's perfect logic. So the safety
it
aspect.
Is.
Yeah.
Greg, I'm so sorry.
The converse, which is probably for a different show, is that with all this SDM stuff, we have to figure out how to make it predictable enough that the operations guys at either a large enterprise or a carrier can actually operate the network.
The
network's going to do something with your traffic, but we don't know what.
Yeah. Visibility. Visibility. All the surveys that I've seen and all the research I've been doing lately, the biggest single problem we have with networking is that it's invisible. We can't see what's going on inside the devices, and we don't have the necessary capability to extract data from the network and visualize what's happening either.
And that's what I2RS is intended to help.
Okay, then that's what we're interested in. That's what we want to see, more of that.
Well, there was a good introduction to I2RS, which is kind of in the SDN family of protocols, and it is an early work at this point. We did an overview of it, and it's not a bad time for you to jump in if you want to get involved and see what is going on with I2RS. And I want to thank Joel and Russ for joining us today. And starting with Joel, do people have the opportunity to follow you on the internet? Do you blog or tweet or any of those sorts of things?
No, I have not gotten involved in those sorts of mechanisms. I follow Google+, but I don't post there often enough for anybody to care. I do respond to email, and I'm happy. Even to anybody ask a question, I'd rather people besiege my email box. You won't make much difference in the volume I have to deal with. And that's jmh@joelhalpern.com. If I discover that folks are interested enough, maybe I'll start posting more often. But I don't currently participate in the social media.
Great. Thank you very much. And then, Russ, why don't we move on to you? I know that you're going to be speaking at Interop and NANOG, you mentioned, and the book is coming out. And how can folks follow you on the internet or read your blogs, any of those sorts of things?
The Art of Network Architecture is coming out. I'm speaking at NANOG next week on network complexity, which actually be a really cool show, by the way, Ethan. It's a really neat thing. And hint, hint. And let's see, I'm speaking at Interop on network topologies and organic growth. And other than that, I blog at Packet Pushers. Is about the only place I blog right now, and my Twitter handle is Routing Geek, RTGGEEK. Other than that, you can catch me on email. I'm on Google+. I don't pay much attention to it. I'm on LinkedIn if anybody wants to connect with me there. Various other places like that.
Well, thanks to both of you for taking the time this afternoon to chat with us. Mr. Farrow, you kind of introed the show with a whole bunch of your projects that you're doing in the Palace of Productivity. Anything else you'd like to conclude with?
A couple of things. So we are looking for people to sponsor the shows on a business note. So if you're a vendor listening, these community shows can be sponsored, and we can plug your product in between the guests talking, and that would help us to transition into even more content, more and better content. And people would rate the show in iTunes, it would be a huge help. If you could go to your favorite podcast thing and say how awesome Packet Pushers is, it helps us to get noticed by other people, because the ratings actually trigger the SEO engines to lift us up toward the top. So, and one last thing, I started a new podcast this week currently called The Coffee Break, which is myself and Andrew Connery Murray, who people may or may not know. And we're actually doing the business side of this discussion. So this show is the nerd dive, where we take off our clothes and roll around in IETF standards and wash ourselves down with routing protocols and bits and rub our hair down with, you know, frames. But the coffee break is absolutely about the business side of it. You know, this vendor did this, this product was announced, what does that mean to the market? So if that's more your thing, you might want to tune into the community podcast.
Yeah, Andrew is an outstanding person to have on as a co-host for that show. I mean, his background is writer for Network Computing, editor for Network Computing, and now he's moved on from that, and he's basically in charge of Interop. I mean, he's not at the very top of the chain, but he's the guy that's helping to make that show happen. So he's certainly got a lot of insight in the industry, understand what's going on the business side of things, for darn sure. And very nice guy, too. I've had the chance to meet him a couple of times. Just a great guy.
Absolutely. So it is the first show to be in the community podcast feed. And the community podcast feed is a place where anybody can bring their podcast to the Packet Pushers Network to share with the community. So this is your invitation to join in. If a show can go through enough iterations, so if you can publish a show over a period of time and show us that you're committed, then there's a good chance we'll make you into your own channel. But maybe you've got a show that you just want to record once a month or once whenever you've got something to say. Here's your opportunity to contribute and share with the community, and we'd love to have you, because that's what the Packet Pushers is all about. So Community Podcast has a new show called Coffee Break in it, once we work out a name for the show, because we have
to. Yeah, but then that bigger news is, just like we have the community blog where, dozens if not hundreds of you have contributed to at this point, then now you have an audio option as well. So we'll make it easy for you to get a podcast started. And as always, packetpushers@gmail.com. If you're interested in that, we'll work with you on how that would work and just the mechanics of making it happen. So I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. I appreciate it if you would follow me, and you can follow my content on my blog, ethancbanks.com. And of course, this has been the Packet Pushers podcast. Our hub site is packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter @packetpushers. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.